3:05 UTC right after the international news.
Due to the global outbreak of the coronavirus, the Voice of America is taking every necessary precaution to safeguard its employees, so our broadcast will look a little different today and in the near future as we reduce our staffing at VOA headquarters here in Washington. We appreciate your staying with us on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, coming to you from my home in Arlington, Virginia, the suburb of Washington, D.C. I am Shaka Sali, and today we will discuss how agriculture can become a critical pathway to prosperity in Africa.
Joining us today is Dr. Debisi Araba, the Managing Director of the African Green Revolution Forum, and he joins us from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Well, I have to say that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you for the first time on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa, Dr. Debisi Araba.
Thank you very much, Shaka. It's an honor and a privilege to be here.
You're most welcome. I have to say that you come very, very highly recommended, meaning that your reputation precedes you.
Well, I hope to live up to the expectations of the audience and listeners today. And I look forward to a vibrant conversation with you.
Thank you very much. First of all, before we go anywhere really, what is the African Green Revolution Forum?
Well, thank you very much, Shaka. So we're now known by the Initialism, AGRF. The AGRF is a platform. It's a community of platforms focused on helping all partners working with or for the African continent on effective agricultural transformation. And when we say agricultural transformation, of course, I mean a public sector-enabled, private sector-led process. And so all partners involved in that process are facilitated and enabled via the AGRF.
Well, what is the difference between what you call the AGRF and AGRA, the Alliance for the Green Revolution for Africa?
Yes, AGRA, the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, and the AGRF indeed have a complementary relationship. We also have a similar history. So beginning with AGRA, AGRA is an institution focused on inclusive agriculture transformation on the continent of Africa. They are the premier transformation agency for the agri-food sector on the continent. AGRA is also a member of the partners group within the AGRF. As I mentioned, the AGRF is a community of platforms. So within that, we have 26 partners who make up the group, the partners group of the AGRF. AGRA is one of those. And of course, AGRA also hosts the AGRF.
What is the goal for the African Green Revolution Forum?
Good. The goal is agriculture, inclusive agricultural transformation. And of course, we understand that agriculture transformation is not an event. It is a process that continues to evolve, ensuring that Africa and Africans are able to not just feed themselves, but become the agri-food sector within the continent can become a powerhouse for feeding the rest of the world.
What are some of the lessons that you learned previously, especially at the International Center for Tropical Agriculture, which is based in Colombia. And also, by the way, during the time that you acted as the senior advisor to the Nigerian Minister of Agriculture, who happens to be the current president of the African Development Bank, Dr. Adesina.
Let me begin by saying Africa can feed itself and Africa can feed the world. I am convinced of this fact. Now, prior to joining the AGRF, an institution I joined in May this year, I was the Africa Regional Director at the International Center for Tropical Agriculture, SIAT, now a member of the Alliance of Biodiversity International and SIAT. This is an international research organization that is part of the CGIAR, the International Agriculture Research Consortium. At SIAT, for 4 years, I led research development and strategy on the continent of Africa to engage on how we could provide the evidence base, using science as an evidence base for agriculture development and prosperity on the continent. Two things I would like to highlight here. Of course, we can always come back to my time here. One of the big achievements that I was really proud of was setting out a clear and defined roadmap for research, for the research agenda on the continent, and ensuring that scientists understood that to move the or to advance the agriculture development agenda, we needed scientists to become more political in their thinking, and politicians to understand science, because this partnership is needed. And you also need the private sector to be able to create the enabling environment for the private sector to lead. And so how do we leverage the science, curate the science, develop the science that provides the information for private entrepreneurs at all levels? You know, so I know some of your listeners might have heard of the term smallholder farmers. These are people at the production hub of agriculture and food systems at the small scale. But it's not just smallholder farmers we're looking at. We're looking at every single actor along and around the agri-food space. So people producing at the smallholder level, people producing at the large scale level, and everybody in between. So those working in aggregation, those working on finance, those working on infrastructure development, etc. The lesson I learned from supporting the research agenda, as I mentioned, is Africa can feed the world. And I believe the catalyst or the conduit to achieving this reality is through partnerships. We need to understand that we are all on a journey and we need to support each other on this journey. Of course, prior to joining the International Center for Tropical Agriculture, I was a senior advisor to the Minister of Agriculture. And there I, in addition to supporting the minister directly, I was also responsible for building resilience within the agriculture transformation agenda policy portfolio of the administration. And it was an exciting period, I think, you know, understanding, traveling across the country, Nigeria, and seeing the transformative potential that agriculture, you know, when done right, when you align the policy incentives for the private sector to lead, you have the right evidence base that informs the public policy frameworks. It looks almost magical when things work. And, you know, when you've seen success, you know, I think you never want to go back to mediocrity. And so once you've seen success, you know that this can be scaled and replicated not just across the country, but across the continent. And so I am a firm believer in the potential of agriculture to be a catalytic subsector of the global economy, to transform the lives and livelihoods of millions of people.
To what extent would you say that the coronavirus pandemic has somewhat not been helpful in as far as your role or your job is concerned?
Wow, that's a multi-layered question, Shaka. I'll begin by saying no one, absolutely no one, even those who potentially envisioned a global pandemic could have predicted the second and third order effects of the actions we would have taken, how global economies just shut down overnight. And so I like to sort of assure or reassure people that 2020 is not an annus horribilis. It's not the worst year on record. What it is, it's a shock to the system to let us understand that our global economy has its vulnerabilities, you know. And so what happens in China has the potential to impact what happens in Kenya and vice versa. Now, we've had countries close their borders, not just to trade, but to movements of goods, services, people. And that has also potentially, you know, caused a friction in the flow of ideas and innovation around the world. But what it's also done is opened up other avenues for collaboration and innovation. For example, I probably wouldn't be having or sitting here and having this virtual interview with you if there wasn't a pandemic. We might have been talking about, you know, arranging for an interview the next time I was passing through DC, for example, you know, and that might have taken 6, 8, 12 months. But now, you know, you can just pick up a phone and ask someone, you know, can you, you know, log on online and have a conversation? And so I think in some ways we have the silver linings. But for agri-food systems specifically, I think, yes, there's been the global slowdown in productivity. You know, we've seen the reduction in productivity. We've also seen a reduction in demand. And so it's exposed, as I said earlier, certain fragilities and vulnerabilities in the agri-food systems. Of course, the world is far more interconnected and globalized than it was a century ago when we had the last global pandemic. But what this global pandemic has shown us is that there's a lot more that we need to do as practice and thought leaders in strengthening resilience to shocks and stresses. Previously, we were preoccupied with climate change. It's not like climate change has decided to take a pause because we have a global pandemic. We're still dealing with climate change. We're still dealing with malnutrition, you know, and now on top of all this, we have a global pandemic. And so what this tells me really is agriculture and food systems is a sector that requires the smartest minds. You know, you cannot have people, you know, not pulling their weight. You really need your brightest thinkers, your bravest practitioners, your fiercest entrepreneurs, your most ambitious and visionary public policy specialists to ensure that we build resilient systems around agri-food systems, not just at the local level, but at the country, regional, and global levels.
Talking about climate change, we recently experienced, for example, drought, very, very serious drought in Southern Africa, and also floods.
That's correct. I mean, that's the conundrum that is climate change. We have variability in precipitation, it's rainfall, and temperature. So some places are getting wetter, others are getting drier, some places are getting hotter, other parts are getting cooler, but it's not even on a linear trajectory. So it's variable. In some seasons, you have extreme wet conditions. In subsequent seasons, you have extreme dry conditions. Take, for example, Nigeria. Most recently, parts of Nigeria have been inundated with floods, devastating large agrarian states in the north of the country. I've been reading reports of most of the rice crop for this season being lost. So, you know, when you see these kinds of things, it's also then balanced by a recent report I was reading online today that Cape Town, all the dams in Cape Town are now full to capacity. And so you think, hang on, you know, Cape Town was previously suffering a drought, and now you have floods in other parts of the world. So you have this variability. Unfortunately, we cannot control these parameters. And so when we look at the impact, the sort of the knock-on impact on the Earth's ability to sustain not just life, but sustain life in a manner that is conducive for human beings to maximize their potential individually and collectively, we realize there's a lot more that we need to do. And within the AGRF partners group, we have partners who are working, you know, assiduously towards ensuring that we build resilient systems to ensure that the agriculture and food systems can absorb the shocks and stresses of climate change and bounce back and maintain high levels of productivity. One example was the most recently last week, the African Development Bank inaugurated the Africa office of the Global Center on Adaptation. The Global Center on Adaptation is going to be catalytic. It's going to leverage private sector funds, also influence public sector policy to ensure that at the national and local levels, we can invest in the right infrastructure programs and designs that give us the best chance of building resilient systems that are interconnected.
Very interesting. Here in the United States, Dr. Araba, interestingly, there are still people, and I'm talking about some very powerful people, who are still sort of the doubting Thomases. They still have problems with the climate change. They still have problems with whether it is a science or whether it is a hoax. What about the African authorities? When you interact with them, do you get the sense that they know that when you talk about climate change, you are talking about the real thing, and you should perhaps be able to be guided by science rather than being skeptical?
Yes, thank you very much, Shaka. From my personal experience interacting with the leaders in public sector and also private sector, because again, in the global, shall we call it the global ecosystem of the climate change debate, you still have leaders in private sector as well who are skeptics around whether climate change is real. But you see, the beauty of working with people who have skin in the game, who have their roots connected to the ground, so to speak, is if you've interacted with farmers, or you are involved in the agri-food systems, as you will find most ministers of agriculture invariably are, they will tell you they may not have the hard data, but they can give you anecdotes of a changing climate. The anecdotes that support the fact that the climate is changing. They could tell you the weather, maybe it's the rainfalls weren't this heavy previously, or the rain season wasn't, you know, used to be a longer duration or used to be a shorter duration, or the winters were colder or warmer. They can give you anecdotes that buttress and validate climate change. And so what we're doing on the continent is ensuring that we improve on the communication of science, because science in and of itself is good. Science is sacrosanct. But for science to matter and for science to deliver on the impact and the changes that we require, we really need to be better with our communication. And that's something, I'll give an example. Most recently, a very dear friend of mine, Dr. Bruce Campbell, who leads the CGIAR program on climate change, agriculture, and food security, has been campaigning to improve the communication of science. He feels that scientists need to be better communicators, because that's the only way that we we allow the penny to drop, so to speak, for public policy makers and also for private sector investors. And the reason why it's important, it might be intuitive for why it's important for a government to understand the science of climate change, but why is this important to private sector? Take, for example, an investor. If you're going to invest for the long term in any crop or in any value chain, you really want to ensure that you are hedging your investment and insulating your investment against climate vulnerabilities. And that helps us, you know. So one of the outcomes of this is the improvement in the robustness of climate insurance products, climate finance products and services, instruments that inform the infrastructure that will be built, or the financial instruments that will be created. So there's an increase in sophistication of what's going on in the private sector space now. And I think it's one of the outcomes of improving the communication from the science.
What about the tools or the infrastructure? Do you have the tools, the necessary tools, the appropriate infrastructure?
We have an infrastructure deficit and also a resilience infrastructure deficit, significant one, to the tune of billions of dollars. Now, for us to improve and invest in crowding in more investments, or to crowd in more investments to build resilience, both from public sector and private sector, you really need to up the science and improve the sophistication of the communication of the science. Now, one example of this is the climate risk profiles and the climate smart agriculture investment plans that's been developed by the International Center for Tropical Agriculture, now within the Alliance of Biodiversity International and SEAT. Now, what these profiles do is they look at agri-food chains and tell you at different points of the value chain where the vulnerabilities are. They identify the vulnerabilities, they identify the severity of the vulnerabilities, look at the adaptation measures already adopted by various value chain actors, and then advise on where the gaps are and what can be invested to improve resilience. And I think it's when we take these profiles and others and we map them not just at the subnational level, at the country level, at the regional level, we're able to truly, you know, catalyze not just informing public sector investments, because again, countries have budgets and budgets are limited. And so you really want to inform countries to maximize their budgets every single year. But more importantly, you're starting to see countries become more sophisticated in how they deploy national resources. So countries are engaging with the private sector more, maybe in more blended partnerships, where you are leveraging public resources to catalyze and crowd in private investments. And I think that's the model that we really need to adopt to go to scale. There's so much we still need to do. We need to build those roads. We need to build dams. We need to ensure that there is green energy, sustainable energy, that is not exacerbating the production of greenhouse gases. We need to ensure that the agri-food systems, the world is going to be about 10 billion people by 2050. We want to ensure that our agri-food systems are able to deliver, you know, safe, healthy, nutritious foods to these people in a way that doesn't exacerbate and accelerate climate change.
You know, we talked about climate change and we talked about the effects, for example, of the coronavirus pandemic. What about also the issue of the locust invasion on the East African side? What is the situation like? What does it look like from your vantage point?
Another of the AGRF partners, as I said, we really are the broad-based community of partners. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization is leading the charge on this. They have a monitoring center where they monitor the movement of the swarms of these desert locusts through satellite imagery, visual sighting, etc. And they're also deploying sophisticated containment and control measures. There are lots of investments going into bio pest control measures, understanding the breeding patterns, the swarming patterns of these locusts to see how we can contain them and control them. The locust, as you may be aware, I know your viewers, some of your viewers might have heard this in the news, are still swarming. It is a challenge, a significant challenge. I think for development and donor partners out there, even private sector partners out there, my call is support the people on the front lines. You know, they need your support right now. If your support is in technical services, financial services, it is needed right now. Thoughts and prayers are good, but money is even better. Now, looking at how we control these swarms, we've also seen institutions step up to the plate, like ISIPE, based in Kenya. And ISIPE is focused on understanding the life cycles of these desert locusts and figuring out bioremediation control measures that control the size and movement of the swarms without creating any secondary negative impact on the environment. Of course, you can spray your pesticides, and you know, with the pesticides, you might have a secondary damage either to crops or to livestock. But what we're trying to do is ensure that we control the desert locusts without that secondary impact on any other sector.
What is a CIMI? Are you talking about a respectable research organization?
Set up by a Kenyan, Dr. Odhiambo, and the current Director General is Dr. Segenet Kelemu, who is an Ethiopian national, and who is doing amazing work on the control measures, but also leading research on increasing our knowledge of what's really going on. Because the more we understand the breeding cycles, the patterns of these desert locusts, I think we can move from a reactionary measure to a pro, we can be more proactionary rather than reactionary to the swarms of the desert locusts.
Now, based on what we have discussed so far, talk to us about the situation regarding food security or food insecurity on the continent from your vantage point.
You've possibly heard the saying that we currently produce more than enough food to go around the world. People talk about food loss and food waste as being the limiting factors, the binding constraints, limiting everybody living on the planet or everyone alive on the planet having adequate food. But the question, Shaka, is not just about how much food we have available, because that's looking at calories, right? So when you eat, you look at the package of your food, you see the calorific content, and you've heard people tell you, oh, go on a low-calorie diet, or you shouldn't be exceeding 2,500 or 2,200 calories for men, 1,500 or 1,800 calories for women. That's the energy content in food. But what we need to focus on is the nutritional content. You know, and you have your macronutrients, your carbohydrates, proteins, fats, minerals, you know, but then you have your micronutrients like zinc, iron, vitamin A. Now, these are trace nutrients that lead to what we call hidden hunger, where people have full stomachs. You can eat and be full, but your body isn't receiving adequate nutrition. Let me give you an analogy. When you plant a crop, and people say, or maybe even better, human beings, when you eat, you expect to get most of your nutrients from the food you consume. But once in a while, you might go to your doctor or medical practitioner, and they will prescribe you pills, vitamin pills, multivitamins or certain vitamins. Why are they prescribing those to you? It's because you are deficient in those vitamins, which are critical for healthy well-being. Now, most of the food we consume is supposed to deliver these nutrition outcomes. But the challenge we've had is there's been a focus in previous decades on ramping up the consumption of calorie-dense foods to the detriment of nutrient-dense foods. And so now we are creating a shift, almost a complete, not a complete 180, but a shift to diversify the diets that people consume. We talked earlier about a staple in East Africa, ugali, made from maize meal. You know,
and sukuma wiki.
That's right. You know, the sukuma is probably more critical, you know, to your nutritional outcome than the ugali. But let's even assume you get your energy from the ugali. Mm-hmm. But what we want to do is promote a more diversified diet. So you should be complementing your diet, you know, with the carbohydrates, with the vegetables, which are nutrient dense, you know. And these, the challenge with delivering these nutrient dense foods is most of them are highly perishable, Shaka. And so
I think for the sake of our audience, we should inform them that ugali is a sort of bread that comes out of maize, which is called corn in North America. And right. Sukuma wiki is, as a matter of fact, referred to as the collard greens.
That's correct. Now, how do we develop systems that ensure that we can move these nutrient-dense foods from farms, from where they're produced, to consumers in a condition that is affordable, accessible, safe, and nutritious. We want to